Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm happy today to have with me John Judge. John Judge lives in Washington, D.C. He's a researcher, and I guess you've lived there all your life, John, huh?
I've lived some other places, but I was born in D.C. and live there again now, yeah.
And you grew up, actually, as a son of Pentagon employees in a bedroom community of people who work for the Pentagon, the CIA, the NSA, intelligence agencies, and basically around the secret government. And you were telling the story of how you would hang out as a kid at the Pentagon and hear stories and learn things that probably people had no idea that you were going to keep in mind and take an interest in. And you've been researching all your life since you were a child, actually. And you particularly researched the assassinations of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King. And you have been researching 9/11, what happened with 9/11, September 11th, recently. You're also active in the anti-war, the peace movement, and you have been since 1964. You work with the Vietnam Vets Against War, with the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors, and you're now on the board of the Washington Peace Center, and much, much more. But that's enough to give our listeners some idea of where you're coming from. And I heard you speak here in Oakland, California last night for hours, and you have so much information about what's going on. So we're going to have to really make some choices here and let people know that if they want to know more, they can find it on the Internet. Maybe we'll just say that right now, and then we'll also repeat it again at the end, because probably you're going to want to know more.
Well, the articles that I've posted in my research work to other researchers since last September are at www.raticall.com. You can lead in from the name John Judge and find them in chronological order along with my commentary. Mm-hmm. And those continue to be posted. And some of my other material on my ideas about a solution or real democracy are at a site called open_secrets_2000. And that's within a site called www.geocities.com. So if you go to geocities.com and a / to open secrets 2000, you can find my real democracy material.
Okay. Well, I know there's so much to know, and a lot of the things that I've been learning have been really blowing my mind. And I heard you last night saying some of the same things, a lot more also, but some of the same things that I've been hearing some other people say about foreknowledge, about U.S. involvement in 9/11, and the background of all that. And so I'd like to start out talking about that, and then we'll get into what's happening right now, and if you can lead into it with this issue of the war against the world, really, that has no end. You said the last announcement you heard that it was going to go on for 60 years. I mean, that is really horrendous to be able to announce that a war is going to go on for 60 years. And it's just beyond belief, and people should be, I feel outraged and scared. So I want people to take a stand, and I want us to understand more about that so we can kind of go into that. So let's start with 911.
Well, I was in Washington, D.C. That day. The plane that crashed into the Pentagon, Flight 77 from American Airlines, that happened close enough to me that my house shook and my window shook from the impact of the explosion. I'm right across the river, and I know D.C. I grew up there. And one of the things that struck me very forcefully that day and in the subsequent information that I got was that there was no response to the hijacking of these planes in terms of just standard non-emergency and non-crisis response to any plane that goes off course for several miles or stops communicating with the tower or turns off a transponder. In those cases, the FAA and NORAD, which is a North American Defense Network, have both radar tracking and communication procedures for an interception of the plane and for military planes on ready alert to go up and intercept and try to find out what's the matter with the planes that just go off course. If they're hijacked, of course, it's even more important.
And I would imagine that the most incredible military in the whole world, to which we pay half of our taxes, would have that together. That's kind of their job, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, and these are regular procedures, but none of those procedures were followed on a day when we were in total crisis.
So these are regular procedures.
Yes, these are procedures that, I mean, and I've physically seen in D.C. small private planes or commercial aircraft stray into the restricted airspace there, which has its own separate radar system because it's the most restricted airspace in the country, and things have gone up from the military bases nearby, Andrews, Anacostia, and military jets or helicopters have intercepted these planes and pushed them back out. That's just on a normal day. On September the 11th, we had an unprecedented situation. Four planes were hijacked almost simultaneously. NORAD knew about that as early as 8:25 in the morning, that there were four planes in a hijacked status. And in none of these instances were intercept planes, even though they had a deal of time before these planes got back to the cities and actually hit the buildings, nothing went up. And when I say something goes up, I mean it goes up within 3 to 6 minutes. And even if you don't have them on scramble ready alert, planes can get up within 10 minutes. So we knew after the second tower was hit that this was not even a hijacking, that this was a military attack, planes being used as weapons. And it was announced on local TV in D.C. that Flight 77 and possibly the Flight 93 were coming to D.C. And we knew in advance on local television, which certainly means that the government knew, and they were tracking the plane on the radar. And yet, over 35, 40-minute stretch, absolutely nothing got in the way of this plane. Nothing tried to deflect it or intercept it, much less shoot it down, even though there were reports that there were shoot-down orders given within moments after the second tower was hit by both Cheney and Bush to the military command. Those orders were apparently never translated to the pilots, all of whom say they didn't get such an order. But intercept is automatic, with or without shoot down, and none of that was done. Planes were not even scrambled from off the ground, except from Otis Air Force Base and Langley Air Force Base, they later mentioned. But at the time, they said, we had no mechanism to respond to this emergency. This is the Pentagon speaking. Well, $13 trillion, like you say, since the end of World War II. They don't have a mechanism. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, I know they have a mechanism. I've seen it in operation. In addition to that, I sat on one of their mechanisms when I was 10 years old eating lunch with my parents in the Pentagon courtyard. My dad told me to get off it, and I said, what is it? And he said, it's a surface-to-air missile port. This is the 1950s. The building had that kind of defense. I'm sure they've improved on that kind of defense. In 1997, I encountered another piece of that mechanism when the security guard of the Pentagon, who was taking me for a tour because I was going to do a demonstration in front of the Pentagon, called a day without the Pentagon, and I wasn't meaning to blow it up. I was meaning just what could one day of the Pentagon budget do in terms of social services around this country at a cost of $8,000 a second. What would one day without the Pentagon mean? And to everybody in the country, much less 365 days a year. So it was to highlight that, and he took me outside and told me that they were on Delta alert, their highest alert for security. And he told me they were getting bomb threats every day from Muslims in 1997. Then he pointed up to the top of the building and he said, we have radar up there to make sure they don't try to crash a plane into the building. And he told me that they had aerial surveillance with video cameras. And so they have mechanisms, but they didn't use them on September the 11th. And the planes that were sent up from Otis Air Force Base got to New York, even though they're very close and they can travel potentially 1,800 miles an hour, they got to New York after the second plane had hit the second tower. But even those pilots from Otis told one of the servicemen stationed at the base subsequently that they knew about Flight 77 as well. They knew that there was a flight headed toward D.C., and they turned in the air from New York to intercept that flight, and they were called back to Otis Air Force Base. We also spoke to pilots at Pomona, New Jersey, and they went up on regular military exercises. Fighter pilots were in the air headed toward New York between the two Twin Towers, and they were called back inexplicably to base on an emergency and thought that a family member had died until they got down, and then used civilian personnel to load weapons onto the planes and take off for New York a second time. But, of course, this is after the fact. It did come out that pilots were scrambled from Langley, which is 130 miles to the south of D.C., when we have bases right there in D.C. that can scramble planes and have the same fighters. And at first, it was thought that these planes, again, were scrambled in response to the situation, but got there too late. And it came out in a book called Among the Heroes that these pilots in Langley were scrambled to go to New York. They weren't scrambled to intercept the plane that was still on its way to D.C. And on the way to New York, at one point, they were asked to look to the east and verify that the Pentagon had been hit. And they said they saw plumes of smoke. So they weren't even on the way to defend D.C. D.C. was left defenseless in that hour. So we don't have to be able to answer the question as to whether the government had foreknowledge, although it certainly could have had foreknowledge, and many documents show that perhaps it should or did have foreknowledge. Everyone knew what those planes were doing by 9:05 that morning. And between 9:05 and 9:43, absolutely nothing was done to defend the capital of the United States and the Pentagon itself from that plane.
You also mentioned how the plane flew totally around the Pentagon. Tell that.
It descended from 7,000 feet, looping 270 degrees around the different sides of the Pentagon. It flew so low that it was knocking off lamp poles. And every honest pilot I've talked to tells me that doing that kind of dogfight maneuver in that huge a commercial jet, you have to be a very, very experienced pilot. You don't learn that on a puddle jumper school or on a simulator. In fact, if you do that on a simulator, the simulator shuts down because you're taking the plane out of control. And what was striking to me was that there's no reason to make this loop around the Pentagon. All five sides are open. In a military operation, you'd go for the nearest side, if for no other reason that you don't know whether they're going to use their surface-to-air missile or not. But they went out of their way and way out of their way to hit the one side of the Pentagon that had been under construction for the last 5 years and had nobody in it, basically. The deaths in the Pentagon crash were 124 people on the plane and 64 people on the ground crew, and then maybe 12 or 15 people actually inside the Pentagon because it was mostly empty offices. And if you think about it, as horrific as the 2,000 deaths were in New York, if that plane had gone in at 9:43 instead of at 8:43 in the morning, had gone in when most people would have been to work, it would have been tens of thousands of deaths. So whoever orchestrated and planned this minimized the number of deaths, which is not what you'd expect that an angry terrorist would do. You'd think that they'd want to have the most impact and get the most blood and the most revenge that they could. So just that fact of the planning, if you think about it rationally, I mean, this is a very sophisticated covert operation, whoever it was planned by. And in a covert operation, you make your cover story more elaborate. You spend more time on that and more personnel than you do on the incident itself. And I don't believe that we have as yet gotten to the heart of who's responsible for 9/11 or what actually happened that day.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I've been learning that there's been a lot of history in a lot of countries, including the United States, about staging attacks so that they can then go to war against who they want to. and you know, just there's nothing that unifies people like a common enemy. I mean, we all know that if we look into our own selves and our lives, just with organizations or with anything, you know, our friends for that matter. So you know, a lot of people think this is just all so unbelievable. And to me, as soon as I saw that picture of Osama bin Laden, right away after the buildings were hit, I thought, how did they have that happen? I have that just sitting right there. How do they know he did this? How did they get that up so fast? You know, I was immediately, I certainly don't know what the answer is. I don't know who did what, but I think it's all very suspicious, and it's not that this is never done, that terrible things aren't done by governments to their own people, including ours. I mean, to go to war, which now, I mean, well, we've been bombing Iraq every week for 12 years, but, you know, to actually send Americans to die, I guess people will take that a little, you know, that feels like a not very nice thing, I would think. So, John Judge, if you, I could talk away here, but what do you think about this? Do you think that there's going to be any kind of investigation? What do you think that the chances are for really changing things? And what do you think? These are kind of two different questions. Is the overall, can you sum anything up from your years and years of research about where you think that can help people understand where things are at now and why and where they're going?
Well, I think that, you know, wars begin with lies, and I think Aeschylus the Greek said that truth is the first casualty of war. Staged incidents leading as propaganda into war mark almost every modern war. It's come out historically that the sinking of the Lusitania and the Maine were staged incidents, that the Tonkin Gulf incident of Vietnamese boats supposedly firing into the USS Maddox was in fact CIA ships. But it was used then as an excuse to bomb 10% of the oil refineries in Vietnam and began the U.S. involvement in an active and expanding way in that war. It's come out now historically that there was advanced knowledge and even goading of the Pearl Harbor incident, and that wanting to get into war, Roosevelt and some of his advisors let the attack come as a surprise attack. Not much of this can be claimed with bin Laden, because bin Laden was supposedly at the top of their radar screen for years and had actually been connected to a group that had planted a bomb in those twin towers in 1993. So it hardly makes an attack on them in 2002 a surprise attack, does it? But the Pentagon has insisted, and the White House acting as if all of this was out of the blue and couldn't possibly have been, you know, anticipated. And it's pretty disingenuous. But whether it was something that came from outside or was created to come, it's the case that it wasn't responded to. And what's the net effect is that it does create a new enemy. And if you want social hegemony, if you want the profit of a permanent war economy, you have to keep creating enemies. And when the Soviet Union fell apart, there was a whole move to create terrorism as the new enemy, I believe. And I did a talk in 96 in Los Angeles called "Are You Scared Yet?" about plans that I had seen of the government to increase domestic terrorism and use it as a way to push for an end to civil liberties and get closer to martial law, as well as to create the conditions for a permanent war. Wars are planned. My mother projected draft call figures for wars 5 years in advance. She told me that the war in Vietnam was planned for a major escalation on November 25th, 1963, the Monday following the Kennedy assassination. An order she'd been given to project a withdrawal in Vietnam was reversed into a 10-year war with 57,000 American dead that day, exactly on target 10 years ahead. So when they're telling us they're going into a 60-year war, we better listen, because that's the way they plan it. It doesn't mean we have to sit back and say that that's the plan, there's nothing we can do about it, but we certainly need to take it seriously and realize that these are planned things. And we know already that just what they did in Afghanistan almost started a conflagration in India and Pakistan that could have led to a nuclear war. The world is too interconnected now to be running around starting wars and pretending that they are not going to spread. And so there's very definitely, when you talk about we're going to go into 60 countries, going to last 60 years, that you're setting the preconditions for a conflagration that's going to be worldwide. And I don't think most people want to live with the consequences of what's going to be done in our name if we let that happen. It's not going to improve the economy. It's not going to improve the number of jobs. It's cutting into social services. It's probably going to gut Social Security for this generation to pay for these wars. It's probably going to cost $100 billion for Iraq alone, and $50 billion more to restore the country. So it's a tremendous cost. It's a human cost around the world, and it's a cost of the potential right now of the human race and of the planet itself. And either we're going to go down this nightmare path of ecocide, ethnocide, genocide, and permanent war, or we're going to now say that we are interconnected, that the human community can find peace through justice, and we're going to stop this warlike activity and all this belligerence. We're going to restore hope and justice in the world, which is the cure for terrorism, because terrorism is nothing more than violence and desperation. And we need to then restore a real democracy. It's not the Pentagon that doesn't have a mechanism. It's the American people that are lacking a mechanism to make their popular will felt, to be actually represented in the decisions that are being made in their name and carried out in their name. And that's what we have to do, in the same way that Jefferson and Washington 250 years ago had to envision their liberation, we have to envision ours. We have to envision what democracy would look like. And we're in the 21st century. We have a totally different technology than they had. We have the capability to decide on issues, not on representatives. We can directly allocate our tax. We can open up our commonwealth of the media for full public debate on issues. And we can begin to make decisions where all the people affected by those decisions are involved and where it's real democracy.
Well, you know, I've been really struck about what I'm learning, and I'm not naive. I didn't think I was since I've been an activist all my adult life, and now I'm an elder. But the degrees of the layers of corruption and lies and misinformation and disinformation and what's on purpose, you know, that's planted there, I can't sort it out myself. I'm sure the average person doesn't even know that it's like that, much less or even. Yeah, I feel very overwhelmed, and I certainly feel hopeless too much of the time, and I think that that's not useful, and I try not to stay in that place, and I do a lot of things to keep myself in a good mood, and I also feel scared and tense, and I'm saying this because I know that everybody's feeling those ways, from economic and health problems and to being scared of terrorists, to being scared of the government, or the police, or other people with guns, or, you know, just on and on and on and on and on. So how, and certainly you, John Judge, have been, especially hearing you talk last night for all this time, you have been uncovering a lot of these layers of corruption, lies, and mis and disinformation. So when you say we can do these things, maybe you can be a little more concrete in the few remaining, if you can. and you're on the board of the Washington Peace Center, so I'm sure you think about these things a lot. And if you could, you know, be as specific as you can about some things that we can do to open things up. I mean, do you think it's even worth writing, you know, calling, all that kind of thing that I've heard some people say, well, it's too corrupt. It's certainly Congress doesn't seem too responsive, and the president doesn't seem to care, and he wasn't even elected. That's another. So.
Well, we're disenfranchised, and that's part of what makes us feel so powerless, and I think they want us to get that message that we don't have power, but in fact we have tremendous power, and they're afraid of our power. They're afraid that because they know that there's more of us than we can think. And, you know, It's also our responsibility. We're in the same position, I believe, as the German people were in September of 1939. Poland has been invaded. A world war is looming. A potential Holocaust is beginning that could take out, you know, large percentages of the world population. And the people at the top of this pyramid of wealth certainly don't care. In fact, it's to their benefit to do that. The push is toward genocide when you concentrate wealth this way. So it was up to the German people, really, to stop Hitler, and they didn't. And it's up to the American people to make a change. And actually, there's nobody else with as much power anywhere in the world or as much room to have the democratic right to and the strength to and the capabilities to change this as we have here in this country. And it really rests on us, and we have to take those responsibilities seriously. I think we have to be more inclusive. I think we have to open up a discussion and debate. The media is a commonwealth. It does belong to us. It's licensed bands through a public agency. They have been monopolized.
And we can't just get on on any station, even the community stations, but you certainly can't get on the corporate one. Radio, since I do radio, in the press.
It's corporate controlled, but the corporate control rests on the conditions of a licensing agency. And that licensing agency belongs to the public. And the airwaves belong to the public. And right now we've allowed them to be sold at a dirt cheap rate and monopolized by a few corporations. But it's on us to make those conditions. And part of those conditions could be to tax the time back. In other words, for every 2 hours of commercial time, we take back an hour for public time. And that's a condition of getting a license. What I'm saying is they don't own the airwaves the way they own a mine. Where they've got a deed to it and total control over it, but they do monopolize it. And we should be directly allocating our taxes if we're paying taxes. We should be saying where they're going. That's taxation with representation.
So you're saying that one is an important part of a strategy is to focus on the media, opening up the media.
Yeah, because if we can't communicate, we clearly can't have democracy. Jefferson said, given a choice between a government without a newspaper or a newspaper without a government, he'd always take the latter because information flow is more important to democracy than any of the mechanisms of government could be. And we've got to understand these principles, and we've got to understand, I think, that party politics is inherently anti-democratic. Jefferson and Washington knew that, and knew that parties put the power back in the hands of a few for making policy decisions when those decisions belong to all of us. And we don't lack the technology now to have direct referendum in government. So I think we have choices ahead of us, but the primary choice is to own the responsibility for what's being done in our name. And not to sit back and let people in a secret government make that decision behind closed doors, behind our back, while we just suffer the consequences of it here at home and all the people abroad do as well.
Right. I was just remembering the stories about the Germans who watched the trains go by taking people to concentration camps and all the people, and I've heard so much criticism of people who didn't do anything, and of course, those who did do something a lot of times got, I heard, beheaded. I mean, they got put on the trains too, so it's a risky business. But
yeah, but I mean, the other alternative is that you just die on your knees. I mean, maybe we'll all be dead according to these plans, but I'd rather die standing up and take my chance. And I do think we do have a chance. I think we've got room and a real potential here to change not only our history, but the history of the whole world.
Okay, well, John Judge, our time is up, and give those web pages again where more of your work can be found, because people will, you want to know more, there's lots more to know.
Well, the primary one is www.raticall.com, and look for John Judge on the link page at the front. The other is geocities.com/open_secrets_2000. And you can write to John Judge at P.O. Box 7147 in Washington, D.C. at 20044.
Okay, thank you so much, John Judge. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.